public relations stunt, mostly, to collect information from the public because there was so much outcry from the public of sightings and things that had happened. And the public, particularly Congressman Gerald Ford at the time, was furious that they were debunking events that had happened in Michigan that his constituents said were absolutely right there, here, E.T. craft right here. And Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who later came clean, is also an astrophysicist, made the famous comment that it was swamp gas. And later, of course, he said we knew it wasn't swamp gas. We knew it was E.T. craft. And he left Project Blue Book as their chief consultant and started the Center for UFO Studies there in Chicago. But Professor Condon, around this time, was asked to head up an objective scientific committee to look into whether there was anything, any veracity to UFOs. There was a lot of publicity around it. And like all government committees, it's always, when they form a committee, they already have it, it's a done deal. It's just window dressing. So he headed up this committee, a lot of scientific people, and Dr. Robert Wood, a Cornell PhD, worked for McDonnell Douglas, now part of Boeing. And Dr. Wood, who is one of our Disclosure Project witnesses, told me, and it's in his very lengthy testimony I have. You have to understand I have hundreds of hours of this kind of testimony on videotape. When he was working for McDonnell Douglas, old man McDonald himself asked him to look into UFOs and gather evidence. And so he began to do this. And he discovered a number of things, that A, they were real, B, they were interplanetary, C, they were using a type of gravity control propulsion, and D, most interestingly, in many of the things that he looked into, he found that the ETs had electronic devices that were what I call technology-assisted consciousness and consciousness-assisted technologies, meaning that there was a trans-dimensional nexus between the electronics of these communication devices. This goes at the speed of light. It's just junk, really. It's 1800s technology, and, you know, it's the Morse code. No offense, Apple. But they had technologies that interfaced seamlessly with electronics that would pick up directed intended thought, and which is absolutely true. And actually, the founder of Facebook, Zuckerberg, started talking about a thought switch to interface with computers. I don't know if he's been reading my material, but anyway, I started writing about that in 1990, 1991. And when Dr. Wood saw my comprehensive assessment of the UFO subject, which was written in 91, it got kind of moved through the agency and the aerospace community. And I was just starting this project, very obscure at that time, just this country doctor in North Carolina rattling around in an ER. And it made its way over to McDonnell Douglas, and I got this phone call from Dr. Wood, and he said, "You have no idea how right you are. How do you know this?" I said, "Well, I've had contact, and it's quite obvious. I mean, if you're any thinking person, you're not dealing with electronics that are the speed of light, or travel that's the speed of light. It's too slow, because some of these are from other galaxies, like the picture we have of that one ET that's from Andromeda, 2.5 million light years from here. You know, they're not getting here at the speed of light. It'd take 2.5 million years to get here." So he said, "Well, I really want to meet with you at some point." So we kept in this relationship, and he eventually told me that when he was doing this work for McDonnell Douglas in the 60s, that he was put on the Condon Committee because they thought, because he was a very prestigious aerospace guy at a major aerospace company, that he would be go along with the debunking whitewash of the Condon Committee. And Dr. Wood was someone who started bringing in boatloads of evidence. And it was turning the committee to the fact, no, these are absolutely real. So Professor Condon went to old man McDonald, head of McDonnell Douglas Aerospace, and said, "You fire that son of a bitch so I get him off this committee." And Mr. McDonald said, "No, I'm not going to fire him. He's a very good man." But he was thrown off the Condon Committee. But he didn't lose his job. A McDonald's stood by him. And that's a absolutely true story. And it came out in this cache of documents from the CIA, my God, in 94, that Professor Condon and that committee, some of the key people, were on the payroll of the CIA. And it's in black and white. It's an uncontested document. University of Colorado Boulder, prestigious aerospace guy. And he was carrying water and doing the bidding of the intelligence community, all the time masquerading as an objective scientist. So this is why, you know, I have said, like Seth Shostak and those people who are with SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, they are either the stupidest people in the world or they're on the payroll of somebody to lie to the public. You cannot be that stupid, given the dispositive evidence we put out there. And I actually debated on Voice of America, the head of the SETI project, Seth Shostak, and I had my disclosure project witnesses there. We basically cleaned his clock because the evidence is so dispositive and overwhelming if you go through our material archive. But this happens all the time. So if you just extrapolate that, goes a couple of examples throughout the professorial class and scientific class. It's how it's done. Now, in some cases, it's done not for payment so much as to protect your own reputation. For example, there was a guy named Carl Sagan. Everybody heard know who he is? Anyone? Cosmos series and all that. He actually was on the payroll of the intelligence community. And what happened is that Carl Sagan, there were some improprieties in his PhD thesis, which led to the intelligence community reaching out to him. And they basically said, you're going to tell the public what we're going to tell you to tell the public, or you're going to be washing the floors at Cornell. You're not going to be a professor. And a good friend of his, two of his friends, George Fennell, who co-founded the Extrasolar Planetary Society and founded the Allegheny Observatory outside Pittsburgh, who's on my team, James Mullaney, who is a very eminent astronomer who was the editor of Sky Telescope magazine and astronomy magazine, confirmed to me that this happened to Carl Sagan. And they, one of them told me that he basically aged 30 years in a month because he had to sell his soul to the devil. And so he went from someone looking into UFOs and actually said some positive things about their reality to being a chief debunker of them. And that was a real tragedy because they had what's called oppo research, opposition research, like a political party had. They had dirt on him. And they used it to turn him. But to the public, you know, he was this renowned, respected scientific figure. So just magnify that all through society. That's how it operates. And I know it's not a very pretty picture. It's a little cynical. It's not cynical. It's just a reality. People need to, it's childhood's end here today. Wake up. This is how the world actually works. It's bare knuckle time. And that's one of the big problems is that the same thing happens in the media. Everyone thinks we have a free press. We don't have a free press. We have a free press about things like the stain on the blue dress or something like that. Or other, you know, Kardashian's wardrobe. But on anything really critical like this, we do not have a free press. And I can give you many, many, many examples. I'll only give you a couple. And this involves both the mainstream news media and another one that involves Hollywood. Take this and extrapolate it. Ira Rosen won his Emmy working with Mike Wallace at ABC News. He then became the executive producer, ABC News New York, for Primetime Live in 2020. When we started moving forward with the Disclosure Project, he came out to my farm in Virginia and came out with a production team. I gave him 35 hours of top secret testimony and countless top secret documents. And he says, either this is the biggest hoax in the world or the biggest story in human history. And he says, I think it's the latter. I said, it is. He says, we're going to do a series of town hall meetings with your witnesses, and we're going to do a huge expose on this. I said, I don't think ABC will let you. And he said, I'm the executive producer, and I have final decision over this. I said, Ira, I don't think they'll let you, but I'll cooperate here. you know, here's 20 years of research and all this effort. You can have it on a silver platter. No payment. I'm not a consultant. I give everything away for free. So he goes back to New York. He takes me up there. You know, there's Diane Sawyer and all these guys. Well, you know what's interesting? I said, well, if you can make this happen, it's awesome. So a couple weeks later, he calls me up rather sheepishly. And he says, Dr. Greer, they're not going to let me do this story. And I said, well, Ira, I thought you said you had total control over programming for Primetime Live. He says, Dr. Greer, not for this. And I said, well, who are they? He says, Dr. Greer, you know who they are. And that was the end of it. And we've stayed in touch. He's now back with 60 Minutes. But that was one of the reasons why many of you may have remembered that Mike Wallace went on Larry King Live and had a deep depressive breakdown. And he talked about, he kept saying, I was a fraud, I'm a fraud. And part of it is that a guy named Schwartz, who was on the board of Time Life, and I met, and he was very good friends with Mike Wallace, and Mike Wallace had gotten a hold of a cache of these documents. And I was in New York at a party, and Bob Schwartz said to me, he says, look, he said, the media has become the scribe taking dictation from the right hand of the king, and particularly on something like this. And so Mike Wallace, who was this esteemed investigative reporter, couldn't touch the biggest investigative reporting story in history. And he felt like a total fraud and went into a deep depression over it. If you take Hollywood, the same thing happens. The only movies you really see that come out anymore, now Close Encounters of the Third Kind by Spielberg was a docudrama. He was given access to some of the secret files at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. That's true. If you haven't seen that movie, go see it. It's classic. But in modern times, that was in the 70s, I think, it just isn't possible. The studios are completely mobbed up with people, just like these scientists who actually are on the payroll, with people that respond to the intelligence community. So Arnold Copelson was a huge producer who had multi-billion-dollar in gross sales for his movies, flew me out to L.A. He wanted to do an enormous expose, true life story, be like Argo, but based on my work and what I've done. It'd be a thriller. You know, you have murder, you have mayhem, you have intrigue, you have E.T. contact, you have the whole thing. He loved it. And he was there, and I was at 20th Century Fox, and he had a $60 million discretionary budget to do any movie he wanted, pre-approved, because he was a big name. And I said, well, Arnold, I don't think they're going to let you do this one. He says, oh, yes, I'm Arnold Copelson, and I've done this. And he took me to his vanity wall of all his awards. I said, great, wonderful, give me a call. So he sends one of his chief assistants here to D.C. when we're doing the private closed briefings for members of Congress in April of 1997. And she goes back, and he goes, he said, this is the most incredible bunch of information, because we filmed all that. And so I let him have that closed briefing film. He says, this is going to be the biggest movie. It'll be bigger than E.T. or Close Encounters or any of them. And certainly it would be bigger than something like Avatar. I said, well, good, do it. So, but I don't know if they'll let you. He says, why do you say that? I said, well, let's see. Let's start it down the path and let's see what happens. A few weeks later, I get a call from Arnold Copelson. He says, Dr. Greer, they won't let me do this movie. I said, oh, Arnold, I thought you had this $60 million already in the bank ready to roll. He says, not for this. Fox has killed it, put it in turnaround, faster than 10 light years of light speed. So it went into turnaround and got killed. And turnaround means when you take a film and basically kill it. So that's what happened. And it's happened. I give you this example. If I'd be here until tomorrow morning giving you examples I've had with the media, the mainstream media, where this has happened over and over and over again. So one of the problems is the big media do not allow certain things to be exposed. And we have been brainwashed to think that we're the land of the free and have a free press and a free market, etc. But we do only within a certain confine. But ironically, that confine is a prison. Because how do you have a free market if the most important technologies and information of the last 100 years is sequestered and can't be used. I mean, that's not a free market. That's a managed market and controlled, and it is. Same thing with the media. So that's really how that works, and you need to understand that's a very important component of how magic infiltrates and operates. And keep that in mind whenever you start seeing a major media report. And now with the internet, we can put something out and it can reach. Ironically, we can put a video out and it'll have 5 million views, and it'll reach more people than Larry King Live used to, or most of the CNN talk show hosts get. So luckily, we're able to bypass it now, but back in the good old days. But even then, it's sort of relegated to mainstream. The thing that people respect for their source of news, CBS News, ABC News, CNN, et cetera, and so on, won't touch this in a credible way. And if they start to, and believe me, there have been many initiatives from the Wall Street Journal approached me, wanted to do a huge story, gets killed. So there are operatives that are embedded in the corporate, the integrated corporations of all of these media holding companies. And it will not make it out. And that has been my experience to date. I'd love to be surprised. Now, that then brings into the question of what about the rest of the sectors? And, you know, and someone at the break brought up this question of funding. Because I mentioned towards the end, well, there's $8.5 trillion now that's unaccounted for. Trillion, not billion, trillion. A trillion is 1,000 billion. So in other words, it's a lot of money. And unfortunately, it isn't as obvious as it seems. And this is where, you know, take the children out of the room. Here's how this actually works. So you have, I mentioned, the sort of storefront with the military-industrial unacknowledged special access projects. And that's, you can kind of steal, several billion dollars very easily that way. And each year, I estimate, out of the Treasury of the United States through these operations, it's between $100 and $200 billion. Not, you know, a huge amount, but if you look at the military, intelligence, Homeland Security, FBI, and there are other people, there was a undersecretary for HUD for Bush, George H.W. Bush, who discovered that HUD money, housing and urban development money, was being siphoned off into these black projects. And she started to blow the whistle on it, she got fired. So one of the things you have to begin to get your mind around is how the unacknowledged special access projects can penetrate not just the intelligence and military, but other agencies, and then siphon off funds. And it, you know, you get a trickle here and a trickle, and it becomes this huge river. Now, there's another second and very important way that funding happens, and that is through monetizing products. Now, what do I mean by that? Let's say that your Bell Labs back in the old days, or some of these other large corporations, and you're studying under U.S. funding contracts in these unacknowledged projects a technology, and you figure out, oh, this is really what you can do with an integrated circuit and miniaturize it. Or this is what you can, this, these things we collected off the desert floor in 47 were these little fibrous things that you put a light at one end, boom, it's perfectly transmitted to the other, fiber optics. So you then create a market for it, and you allow some of this out, but there's a huge amount of money made on productizing fiber optics, integrated circuits, miniaturization, microprocessors, things of this sort. So there are spin-offs, and those spin-offs make an enormous amount of money for those companies, even though we, the taxpayers, paid for the R&D, and those folks really didn't invent it. But they benefit from it, from the corporate level. So that enriches the corporation so that it can then self-fund through licensing and productization things that were actually funded by the taxpayer. Now, Big Pharm, the pharmaceutical industry, does this all the time. They take stuff that's being funded at NIH or through university grants. The breakthroughs happen in basic science. They then take it one step further, patent it, license it, and next thing you know, a course of chemotherapy costs you $250,000. That's how it works, like rituximab. So, but that's been done with these high-tech programs since the 40s and 50s. So that's a huge source. So then they have their own funding. But now you can see how they can lift off the reservation away from government even more because they're more independent, corporate. Then there's the banking sector, and this is the big one. You know, the Federal Reserve Board basically just invents money out of thin air when we had the financial crisis a few years ago. In the mainstream Wall Street Journal, you know, it was admitted they basically injected $17 trillion into the banking sector. Trillion. TARP was a small part of this. $800 billion, not much. This is $17 trillion. They basically, at no interest, gave $17 trillion to the gangbangsters, I call them. They are gangbangsters. And those guys who have integrated, if you look at the corporate nexus between the banking and financial sector and these large corporations and these government agencies, there is a nexus that gets woven. And the real power is really in the financial, macroeconomic level. And they basically can fund whatever and whoever they want and can move money around virtually with impunity. They're too big to fail. And at this point, there's a joke that if you think they're being regulated, this is a joke. So the gangbangsters have learned how to use that system, and they have investments and interests and startups, you know, whether it's the Blackstone Group or the Carlyle Group, and this, you know, private banking at J.P. Morgan Chase, and what this and that and the other thing. And so there's this whole labyrinthine system that involves the banking sector. And then there are covert parts of the banking sector. I'll tell you a story of a man who, back when I was working on this, and they made another run after I said no to the head of Army Intelligence when they wanted to buy my silence with $2 billion in slush fund money. I was taken to the Wrigley Mansion in Phoenix one night, and it was a late night meeting, maybe 10, 11 o'clock, and there was a whole group of people. It was like a conference for boardroom in this mansion. And around the table were a whole bunch of suits, and most of them were corporate, a couple government. And they say basically to me, you know, they said, you don't need to bother with someone like the president or the CIA director. They don't know anything, and they're not going to know anything. You need to be meeting with people like, well, us, who do WFO, work for other programs for the government. And there are certain orders of Jesuit priests who are involved with technology transfer policy. I said, what? I thought they were on drugs. And it turned out every word they said was true. And I was just listening. It'd be an interesting movie, wouldn't it? Anyone has cojones to do it. Then they started, this one guy pulled me aside. And he said, you know, we've checked you out. You're a doctor. You have good credit, good income. Take out as many platinum cards as you want. Give them to me. We will then zero out the account balances every month. So you can spend several million dollars a month and we'll just zero it out. Now you put me under sodium pentothal. This actually happened. And I said, well, then you would own me, wouldn't you, Jim? He says, oh, don't look at it that way. We're here trying to help you. I said, no, you would own me. This is fraud, banking fraud. And he says, no, well, you know, just look at it as a friendly hand helping you out. I mean, it's friendly, you know. Devil with forked tongue. And then he started to explain. He says, you know, there are a lot of creative ways where we can get money when we need to. And this guy headed up some folks who do the backup computers for the banking system. And these are big supercomputers. And basically, when you have trillions of dollars daily going back and forth in currency exchange and transactions, there's an odd amount left over that's less than a penny or less than a euro or less than a yen. That gets dropped into a black fund account. And it's a lot of money. It adds up on a daily. If you take 365 days in a year, you've got a lot of money from that. becomes billions, tens of billions. So you have the black budget, unacknowledged projects. You have the corruption and fraud within the government system. You have the productization, monetization of things that we're paying for the study that they then monetize, like integrated circuits and cell phones and fiber optics. Then you have the banking corruption. And then you have the pièce de résistance. And the one that is the most disturbing, and that's drug trade. So the worldwide drug trade, cash and carry, bigger than oil. And when I first heard this from an attorney who was representing a man's family whose husband, a Marine colonel, was murdered because he saw them offloading drugs at a military base in California, I thought this was a bridge too far. I did not actually believe it. And this attorney, a very, very credible guy, Harvard Law, was representing the family to get them to exhume the body because the body was the death was deemed a suicide, and the family knew the man had been murdered because of what he saw, because he had told one family member what he saw. And he was at the wrong place at the wrong time in a restricted landing area, in a restricted facility, where one of our aircraft was offloading a large amount of drugs that would then be sent out through various drug cartels and whatnot. And they killed him because of what he saw. Made it look like a suicide. And I filed that away as data point one. Then I had another data point come in of a woman who owned a 5,000-acre sheep ranch in South Dakota, of all places. But adjacent to it was what had been a chemical weapons storage area and an underground facility. And she had enough resources that she had her own people go out with night scopes and found that there were ARVs, so-called alien reproduction, these man-made anti-gravity things going in and out of this facility, wee hours of the morning. And then she got someone close enough who saw that they were offloading huge amounts of chemical weapons, armaments, and drugs. So arms shipping as well as drug shipping. She contacted Senator Daschle, the senior senator of South Dakota, who started digging into it. He got threatened personally. I have a whole dossier file on this in my vault. And he backed off of it. He ran from it light year, at the speed of light, to get away from it, because they made it very clear, stay away from this, Senator Daschle. He said, I can't help you anymore. So she reached out to me saying, can you help me? Because part of what was happening is that some of these chemical weapons that were stored there were leaking into not only the groundwater, but and where her sheep, and a lot of them were dying. And it was like these containers that were corroding. It was like a Superfund site, but classified. It was a disaster. And that's why she was so concerned. She had 5,000 acres. And I said, look, you know, I'll make some calls and see what I can do. But I've got a heavy lift here I'm doing on my own besides your sheep. But this is a very real case. Then on the day after I met with and briefed the head of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I got a cryptic invitation from two men. My wife and I call them Mr. Allen 1 and Mr. Allen 2. So not their name. It was our code name. I don't want to talk about who they actually are until they're deceased. I can confirm they're deceased. And they invited me over to this condo in Crystal City near National Airport, which turned out was the home of a former congressman who was sort of a consigliere and sort of advisor to George H.W. Bush. And in the room with him was a burly man who was a Science Applications International Corporation executive who was living virtually in retirement exile in France, who had come in for the meeting. And it was shocking what I learned, but not so shocking given what I've just told you. But they said, do you understand how dangerous this group is? I said, yes, I do, personally. And they said, but do you understand what they're really doing? They're destroying our world. They're destroying our planet. They're destroying our country. And these are the ones that have gotten off the reservation even from George H.W. Bush and have escaped control, gangland style. I said, yeah, I know that there are special compartmented operations that are unacknowledged that aren't even under the control of MAGIC anymore, M-A-J-I-C.